Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the first installment of my reading of the classic work by Alfred Maurice de Zayas, titled The Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945. Today's date, June 21st, 2015, happens to be the 74th anniversary of the German preemptive invasion of the Soviet Union, known as the Barbarossa Campaign. The majority of the work of the War Crimes Bureau was with this campaign, called the Eastern Front. This work by Alfred de Zayas was not the very first attempt to bring into light the crimes committed against the German forces and people during World War II. In 1975, 4 years earlier, a compilation of documents and witness statements by POWs held in the Soviet Union was published by the German Organization of Returnees and Organization of the Dispelled, otherwise commonly called the Organization for German Expellees, titled in English, because the German title is too difficult for me to pronounce, but in English translation, the title is The Suppressed History of Crimes Committed on German Soldiers in World War II. Essays based on this book, written by Wilfried Hank, can be found at the Inconvenient History Revisionist blog for the year 2012, the months March, April, and May, in 6 installments, 2 essays in each of these 3 months. You can find these at revblog.codo.com on the internet, revblog.codoh.com. As we know, it was the intention of the Allies to portray the German government of Adolf Hitler and his political party and the German high command of the Wehrmacht as the sole guilty parties in what became total war by 1944 and 1945. The Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau was established to discover and document war crimes committed against German troops. From the introduction, Alfred de Zayas writes, "The military and diplomatic files of the Third Reich have been the object of innumerable scholarly investigations over the past 40 years. Now, remember, this book came out in 1979. The work that had been done was compiled into this book. From 79 goes back to 39, 40 years, so that tells us that this research has not been continued by anybody. The work that de Zayas did and the other books that he wrote about the atrocities committed against the ethnic Germans in the East, which was his main interest. But this has not been continued to any degree, at least the work of the War Crimes Bureau. So this is still the only source of information that we have on it. He goes on to write, "By contrast, and surprisingly enough, the records of the legal department of the high command of the Wehrmacht, as well as those of the legal offices of the wartime German Army, Navy, and Air Force, have remained practically untouched." Well, we can understand why that is. Nobody wants to look at the crimes committed against Germans. As I was trying to say before, the work that he did and his associates stands today as still the only real serious work done on this subject. He continues in his introduction, "These records are not, of course, complete. The files of the German armed forces and most of their bureaus, many of which have been deposited in the military archives at Potsdam, were largely destroyed during World War II, especially in the Great Fire following the Allied air bombardment of 14-15 April 1945. Those documents that escaped, including whatever current files the Germans themselves failed to destroy, were seized by Allied troops. How much military documentation fell into Soviet hands is not known, as relatively few records have been released by the Soviet Union to the military archives of the German Democratic Republic. But a considerable bulk of official records was subsequently transported to the United States. Among these, an important record group that has until recently escaped attention is that of the Wehrmacht German Bureau for the Investigation of War Crimes. Owing to the frequent air bombardment of Berlin, this bureau moved its offices in August 1943 to the town of Torgau on the Elbe River, some 70 miles to the south. With the advance of the Soviet Army in 1945, it moved again, west to Langensalza in Thuringia. There, before the American troops arrived early in April 1945, some government files were thrown into the courtyard of the military barracks and set on fire. Shortly before the American forces linked up with the Red Army on April 25th, the files that remained in Langensalza and Torgau were captured by the U.S. Army's records collecting team and eventually sent to Washington, where they were stored for many years as classified documents out of the reach of scholars. Not until their declassification in 1965 were the files microfilmed and thus made available to researchers at the modern military branch of the National Archives. The documents themselves were shipped back to the Federal Republic of Germany in 1968-69. They are now housed in the military archives in Freiburg in the Bundesarchiv, where they have been provisionally bound in 226 volumes of 100 to 500 pages each. Their use is unrestricted. The task assigned to the Wehrmacht Untersuchungsstelle, or Wehrmacht Investigative Body, was to investigate reports of alleged violations of the laws and customs of war, whether committed by members of the Allies or the Axis armed forces. However, the extant files of the Bureau, estimated to be perhaps half of its total records, include no investigations of Axis war crimes, apart from a thin volume concerning the killing of British prisoners of war in North Africa in 1942. The remaining 225 volumes deal with alleged Allied violations, primarily by the Soviet Union. The bulk of these available records is made up of witness testimony sworn to before German military judges, military intelligence reports, and captured Allied documents add valuable information. The War Crimes Bureau was not a special invention of Nazi Germany, but rather the direct successor to the Prussian Military Bureau of Investigation of Violations of the Laws of War, which had operated during World War I as an organ of the Reich War Ministry. Only a minor portion of that agency's records remain, but a notable continuity between the two agencies was maintained in the person of Johannes Goltzschuh. That's spelled G-O-L-D-S-C-H-E, a military judge who, having been deputy of the Prussian Bureau, was reactivated upon the outbreak of hostilities in 1939 and headed the War Crimes Bureau for the duration of World War II. He headed the War Crimes Bureau for the duration of World War II, the man who was there in World War I. The old and new bureaus had the same task of documenting Allied offenses and submitting reports to the German Foreign Office, which used these reports to lodge diplomatic protests against Allied powers. The members of both bureaus were military judges who either personally questioned the witnesses, mostly members of the armed forces, or delegated the taking of depositions to the competent military or civilian courts in the areas where the witnesses were stationed, hospitalized, or in residence. Skipping a bit, going on to the next page. It is the task of this book to evaluate these records, to examine the establishment, function, and methods of this German Bureau of Investigation, and to try to draw the line between historical events and mere propaganda. In order to do so, the author, that's Desaia speaking of himself, first attempted to determine whether the files gave the impression of genuine investigations, whether the documents showed the various stages of every case, whether contradictions arose, whether there was any indication that evidence might have been fabricated or documents doctored for propaganda purposes. The next step was to establish whether the persons named in the documents, judges, witnesses, and victims, really existed, whether they were actually involved in the cases described, and whether they testified of their own volition or were forced to sign prepared statements. The author interviewed more than 300 judges, witnesses, and victims, and in every case they confirmed the correctness of the protocols. Frequently, they were able to provide additional information, carbon copies of the same or other depositions, and sometimes even pertinent snapshots taken by themselves or their comrades. Valuable information was added by numerous other witnesses who had not given wartime depositions but could confirm the events described in the documents. The final effort consisted in verifying the events dealt with in the Bureau's documents by consulting other German record groups and also the relevant American, British, French, and Swiss files. In the political archives, that is in the German Foreign Office in Bonn, he's listing here where he checked documents, where he got documents. In the German documents in Bonn, in the public record office, the Foreign Office, the War Office, the Air Ministry, and the Admiralty in London, in the National Archives of the U.S., the State Department, the War Department, SHAF, Judge Advocate General in Washington, and in the Swiss Federal Archives in Bern, there are many documents that help to complete the picture. All in all, the coherency of the War Crimes Bureau files, the confirmation of persons involved, and the comparison with other historical sources justify the conclusion that the Bureau did function in a trustworthy manner, that its investigations were authentic, and its documentation reliable. Though there is no guarantee that the depositions are correct in every detail, and though the files, of course, contain only the German view of the events, it is nevertheless evident that the Bureau was not a propaganda arm of the Nazi regime, but a military investigative agency, much like those that exist in the legal offices of the armed forces of many other nations. The historical and legal scope of this book has determined its arrangement into two parts, a history of the Bureau itself and a selection of case studies. In Part 1, a description of the origin, task, and organization of the Bureau is followed by an examination of how it functioned in practice and the uses to which its results were put by the German Foreign Office and other agencies. Part 2 illustrates the Bureau's work by presenting a number of concrete examples representing investigations carried out during the various phases of the war and in all its theaters. Well, that's all I'm going to read from the introduction, so I'm going now to Part 1, which is titled History, Methods, and Uses of the War Crimes Bureau, what was just described a moment ago. And Chapter 1 in this Part 1 is titled Predecessors and Parallel Organizations. From now on, I'm going to read everything on all these pages. I'm not going to just pick out certain parts. So we'll probably get through Chapter 2 today, but we'll see how it goes. I'm beginning now with Chapter 1, as I just said, Predecessors and Parallel Organizations. The activity of the German War Crimes Bureau must be seen in the context of the gradual development of the laws of war since the end of the 19th century and the emergence of national and international commissions to monitor their implementation. At the Peace Conference of The Hague in 1899 and 1907, the laws and customs of war were scrutinized, part of them being codified in the form of regulations annexed to the Hague Convention 4, respecting the laws and customs of war on land. On the basis of these regulations, military lawyers developed criteria according to which the legality of the behavior of soldiers on the field could be tested. Although inspired by humanitarian considerations, these regulations also reflect the political realities of state interests. The violation of the laws of war may have manifold consequences. The perpetrator can be held personally responsible and court-martialed by his own military or brought before an enemy tribunal. The state whose citizens become victims of a violation may take such diplomatic steps as official protest via the institution of the protecting power. There is a general obligation on the part of the offending state to provide compensation. Moreover, war crimes accusations constitute an important part of modern war propaganda. In both world wars, the belligerent parties established, for judicial and political reasons, special commissions to investigate reported instances of war crimes by the enemy forces. The next section, this is still in chapter one, but it's got little subheadings, is Allied investigations of German war crimes in World War I. Scarcely a week after the outbreak of hostilities in 1914, a special Belgian commission was set up on 8 August, which quickly produced a number of accusations. A report dated 16 September 1914 in a Belgian Grey Book. These documents concern the killing of hostages, arson, the destruction of cities such as Louvain, instances of rape, and the alleged mutilation of children's hands by German invaders. In December 1914, Great Britain set up a commission under Lord James Bryce to investigate reports of war crimes committed by the German army in Belgium and the north of France. In the course of the war, Great Britain protested a number of events, in particular those involving German submarine warfare, such as the sinking of the hospital ship Landovery Castle on 27 June 1918 by the German submarine U-86 under the command of Helmut Patzig. Survivors reported that they were shot at and many were killed following the sinking. French protests accused Germany of damaging the Cathedral of Reims and of ill-treating French prisoners of war. After the armistice in November 1918, the victorious Allies pooled their reports on German violations of the laws of war. A special Allied commission compiled a joint list of German war crimes and demanded the extradition of some 900 persons. The commission's report provided the legal basis for the extradition lists and for Articles 228 and 229 of the Treaty of Versailles, signed by Germany on 28 June 1919, by which the German government recognized the right of the Allied and associated powers to bring before military tribunals German officers and soldiers accused of having committed acts in violation of the laws and customs of war. Because the idea of extraditing German soldiers for prosecution in Paris or London proved extremely unpopular in Germany, however, the German government negotiated with the Allies to modify the prosecution requirement by allowing the accused Germans to be tried by the German Supreme Court in Leipzig. In the Landovery Castle case, Commander Helmut Patzig was at large, and first boatswain mate Meissner, who was reported to have shot at the shipwreck, had died before the trial opened. This is why only Lieutenants Ludwig Dittmar and John Bolt, who were reported to have been on deck at the time of the firing, appeared before the court in Leipzig. They were found guilty of manslaughter, and on 16th July 1921, sentenced to 4 years imprisonment. Patzig's orders were regarded as a mitigating circumstance. On May 26, 1921, the court sentenced, this is the German court in Leipzig, the court sentenced Sergeant Karl Hainen, in charge of a prisoner of war camp in Herne, to 6 months imprisonment for ill treatment of prisoners. On 2nd June 1921, the court sentenced Private Robert Newman and Captain Emil Müller, commander of the prison camp Flaby Le Martel, to 6 months imprisonment, also for ill treatment of prisoners. Major Benno Crucius was convicted of having passed down an order of General Karl Stenger not to take any French prisoners and thus to have been responsible for the killing of French soldiers. On 21st August 1921, the court sentenced him to 2 years imprisonment. By Nuremberg standards, this would appear very lenient, but again the court considered that superior orders constituted mitigating circumstances. Generally speaking, the German population took exception to these trials, especially because the Allies were not similarly bringing their own soldiers to justice. this next section is subheaded German Investigation of Allied War Crimes in World War I. The Allies were not alone in compiling lists of enemy excesses. On 19 October 1914, the Military Bureau of Investigation of Violations of the Laws of War was established in the Prussian War Ministry to determine violations of the laws and customs of war which enemy military and civilian persons have committed against the Prussian troops and to investigate whatever accusations of this nature are made by the enemy against members of the Prussian army, unquote. This Military Bureau of Investigation of Violations of the Law of War had wide competence to establish facts in a judicial manner and to secure the evidence necessary for legal analysis of each case. Witnesses were interrogated and their sworn depositions taken by military judges. Lists of suspected war criminals were compiled, which would probably have led to criminal proceedings if Germany had won the war. The material remained largely secret, though some excerpts from witness depositions were used in German white books. One of the first activities of the Prussian Bureau was the investigation of alleged Franc-Tireur activity on the part of Belgian civilians. As early as September 1914, even before the investigative agency was established, German military judges had taken the depositions of many witnesses. More were taken in October, November, and December 1914, mainly in Louvain and Brussels, by 7 military judges accompanied by 8 court officers. In addition, a number of German witnesses who were no longer in Belgium were interrogated by local courts in their home districts in Germany. After due examination of all the material collected, an internal report on the Belgian resistance in Louvain, dated 15 January 1915, was prepared by the Prussian Bureau of Investigation. Belgian accusations of German war crimes in Louvain were countered by 73 witness depositions, primarily from German officers and soldiers. According to this testimony, the occupying Germans were suddenly attacked by civilians on 25 August 1914, losing some 30 men and 95 horses. When houses were searched for suspects, some of these persons were shot in the ensuing struggle. A number of them were made prisoner while still bearing arms. That's all been a quote from General Max von Bain, and he went on stating, "Among those who were caught in the act and immediately shot were a number of persons in very disorderly work attire. Residents of the town claimed not to know these persons and never have to seen them in Louvain. Further, 300 rifles had been found in a Louvain church, and the chief medical officer, Dr. Georg Berghausen, testified that a number of wounded German soldiers had been shot with hunting guns." On 10th May 1915, the German Foreign Office produced a white book titled The Illegal Belgian Civilian Warfare, based almost exclusively on the report prepared by the Prussian Bureau. Because the judicial depositions were shortened and some adjustments, put in quotes, made to make the evidence appear more convincing. However, the White Book is a far less reliable source than the original protocols. In 1917, the Belgian government in exile published another Grey Book contradicting the German White Book, and the British government published the 1915 Bryce Report. By way of reaction, the Prussian Bureau of Investigation produced a second report on civilian warfare in Belgium, critically analyzing the Belgian Grey Book and rejecting atrocity propaganda against German soldiers. The Prussian Bureau also devoted considerable time to the investigation of reported abuses by British and French soldiers. In 1915, upon request of the German Foreign Office, it prepared a special, quote, response to accusations made by the French government, unquote. That's the title, which rebutted French accusations and presented 128 judicial depositions documenting French violations of the laws of war. Also in 1915, the Bureau published The Bombardment of the Cathedral of Reims contending that the French army had provoked German fire by using the towers of the cathedral for military purposes. The brochure contains excerpts from French and British newspapers which report the use of church towers for military surveillance purposes. Another volume, France and the Laws of War, Atrocities on the Front, includes 157 reported cases of the killing of prisoners of war and other defenseless persons, wounding, ill-treatment, and robbing of prisoners, endangerment of prisoners by using them as a protecting shield against enemy forces, shackling and chaining of prisoners, mutilation of corpses, threats for the purpose of obtaining information, and so on. The treatment of German prisoners of war in French camps was detailed in a 1918 report, France and the Geneva Convention. Part of a report titled British Violations of the Laws of War in Belgium and France, which was prepared but never printed, was incorporated into British Violations of the Laws of War against members of the German armed forces at the front, which comprises 355 cases through the summer of 1918. The preface to this volume focuses on the validity of its evidence. Quote, the German investigation rests preponderantly on the sworn testimony of credible witnesses. Only where, in some exceptional cases, a sworn deposition could not be taken by a competent judicial officer, owing to war conditions, did the Wehrmacht investigative body dispense with the requirement. The documents annexed as substantiation are true in unabridged transcriptions of the originals of these documents, which are kept in a special dossier. Impartial observers will not fail to notice that the testimony also contains positive comments made by the witnesses with regard to the behavior of enemy soldiers, unquote. It is interesting to note that in some investigations, the Prussian Bureau was able to incorporate evidence from non-German sources, as it did with regard to the Barillon case. On 19 August 1915, the British steamer Nicosian, was on its way from New Orleans to Avonmouth, laden with 350 mules, when it was intercepted by a German submarine 17 nautical miles south of Queenstown, Ireland. The submarine allowed the whole crew to take to the lifeboats before bombarding the ship. At this time, another ship arrived on the scene, which later turned out to be the British auxiliary cruiser Barillon. It flew the colors of the United States, not then at war with Germany, and signaled the German submarine that at the request of the crew of the Nicosian, it would grant assistance. Shortly thereafter, it opened fire on the German submarine and sank it, the American flag being lowered only after the Barillon had launched its attack. Five of the shipwrecked German crew were able to seek refuge in the Nicosian, but were killed under orders of British Captain McBride. Others who were holding on to the Nicosian's ropes were shot by the crew of the Barillon. The German captain, who, while swimming, signaled his surrender by raising his hands, suffered the same fate. Since there were no German survivors, the Prussian Bureau first learned of the incident through the testimony of American sailors from the Nicosian to the American consul in Liverpool, upon their arrival there, information which subsequently reached Germany by way of German consulates in the United States. The consulates made arrangements to take sworn depositions of those American sailors who wished to testify and sent the documents to the German Foreign Office, which on 28 November 1915 issued a white book in English and German. It was called Memorandum from the German government concerning the murder of the crew of a German submarine by the commander of the British auxiliary cruiser Barillon. Long before the White Book's publication, the U.S. State Department had received the text of the testimony of the American sailors at Liverpool, and on 18 October 1915, Secretary of State Robert Lansing telegraphed the American ambassador in London, Walter Page was his name, asking him to inquire of British Foreign Minister Sir Edward Grey whether the British ship Barillon had in fact flown the American flag. On 22nd October, Page answered that the sailor's affidavit sent to the State Department on 26th and 29th August, quote, are, of course, authentic. In all essential points, they agree. They were made by American citizens before our consul at Liverpool, Mr. Washington, that's the consul. And I assume that they are such conclusive evidence of what happened that any representations that you may wish to make regarding the use of our flag may be made without asking Sir Edward Grey to verify or deny the fact of its use. That fact is established, unquote. That's what the Americans said. On 28th November 1915, the German government officially presented to James Girard, the American ambassador in Berlin, the German Barralong Memorandum with the request that it be transmitted to the British government. Girard forwarded the document to his colleague Page, who on 6 December 1915 transmitted it without commentary to Sir Edward Grey. Grey responded in a note dated 14 December 1915, quote, His Majesty's government do not think it necessary to make any reply to the suggestion that the British Navy has been guilty of inhumanity. According to the latest figures available, the number of German sailors rescued from drowning, often in circumstances of great difficulty and peril, amounts to 1,150. The German Navy can show no such record, perhaps through want of opportunity, end quote. Well, here we see that they get out of that by saying they're not going to make any reply to that because they have a record of saving, rescuing many, many German sailors from the sea. So in this other instance where they didn't do that, they're just not going to comment about it. They see it as insulting to them, I guess. Anyway, continuing, the Prussian Bureau nevertheless included the name of the Barralong's Captain McBride in its black list of Englishmen who are guilty of violations of the laws of war vis-a-vis members of the German armed forces. That's another long title. So, that's that story. We go to another subheading here, German Investigation After World War I. The Prussian Bureau of Investigation did not cease to exist in November 1918, but continued to collect evidence, which it used in several memoranda issued in 1919, during and after the Versailles Conference. Even before the Allies agreed to have war crimes tried in Leipzig, the German Parliament established a, quote, Central Bureau for the Defense of Germans Accused of War Crimes. At an early meeting of this bureau in Berlin on 4th October 1919, Johannes Goltschiff spoke on behalf of the Prussian Bureau of Investigation. He reported that his office had prepared some 5,000 dossiers on Allied war crimes consisting of depositions of witnesses and supporting material which were properly indexed and immediately available to German Defense Counsel in case of trials against German soldiers. There were also records of investigation of Allied allegations of German war crimes. That material, however, had not been published because the German government feared possible repercussions in Allied countries. The democratic government of the Weimar Republic, touched to the quick by Allied accusations of German war crimes, repeatedly proposed that an international commission be established to examine mutual allegations of violations of the laws of war. Even the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, at its 10th International Conference in Geneva in 1921, resolved that an international investigation of the violation of the Geneva Conventions during the war should be carried out. The Allied powers, however, declined to give any reply to the proposal, and the Red Cross resolution was never implemented. The Weimar Republic, pursuant to Article 34 of its Constitution, and in accordance with the motion of the 8th Constitutional Committee of the German Parliament on 20th August 1919, established a special committee with 28 members assigned to determine whether on the German side military or economic methods of warfare had been employed or tolerated which violated the provisions of international law or were unnecessarily cruel and unjust, and also whether other belligerent parties had used such methods. On 30th September 1919, the committee delegated its task to four subcommittees. The third, chaired by several distinguished members of the Weimar Parliament, including ex-minister Johannes Bell of the Center Party, was entrusted with the most delicate task, which was determining what war crimes had in fact been committed and by whom, so as not to interfere with the proceedings then pending before the Supreme Court at Leipzig. The subcommittee first focused on the question whether appropriate measures had been taken by the German authorities in time of peace to instruct German officers and men in the relevant provisions of the Hague and Geneva Conventions. Only later did it turn to its main task, relying primarily on the work of the Prussian Bureau of Investigation and the Central Committee of the German Red Cross, including the special report, Violations of the Geneva Convention by States Hostile to Germany During the Last War. These materials were carefully weighed in the report submitted by Christian Mehrer, professor of international law at the University of Würzburg. Violations of the Geneva Convention, that's one, and another, violations of the law on prisoners of war. These were reports submitted by Christian Mehrer. While recognizing that even sworn testimony may not stand examination in adversary proceedings, the committee was nevertheless of the opinion, quote, in the light of the statistics kept by Germany's former enemies with regard to the very high death toll among German prisoners of war, that their life and health was not protected to the extent provided for in international law, unquote. Mehrer's reports describe, for instance, the conditions in which German POWs were kept in Russia, where over 39% of them perished. Considerable attention is also focused on testimony regarding the methods of warfare employed by colonial soldiers in the French and British armed forces. After 7 years of methodical investigations, the subcommittee presented its findings in five volumes titled International Law During the World War. The report was never translated, however, and thus had practically no impact outside of Germany. Next section is subtitled Parallel Agencies During World War II. As direct successor to the Prussian Bureau, the German government established on 4th September 1939, barely 3 days after the German invasion of Poland, the new War Crimes Bureau, this time not as a bureau in the War Ministry as such, but as a special section within the legal department of the Military High Command, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, or OKW, or OKW. As could be expected, similar agencies were set up by the Allied governments. In the British Foreign Office, Roger Allen was responsible for the collection of all reports concerning German violations of the law of war. Very early in the war, he started producing internal papers on German war crimes, the monthly called, in quotes, Atrocities Summary. And since British warfare against Germany took place primarily on the high seas, the Royal Navy was principally involved in examining German methods of warfare and systematically interrogated all survivors of sunken merchant ships in order to discover possible violations by the German Navy. The Soviet Union was also active in collecting evidence of German abuses. On 25th January 1941, shortly after the German invasion, the Soviet government instructed the chief medical officer of the Red Army as follows, quote, in order to reveal the plundering nature of the fascist conqueror in the eyes of world public opinion, it is necessary to publish in detail all bestial war methods employed by the fascists, all instances of fascist atrocities against medical personnel must be carefully noted and documented with photographs, protocols, organization reports, individuals or collective descriptions by soldiers and civilians involved, unquote. On 25th February 1942, quote, specific, quote, guidelines for collecting, evaluating, and keeping documents on atrocities, destructions, plunder, and rape committed by Germans in occupied Soviet areas were issued by Major Nikitinsky, Chief of Administration of the State Archives of the NKVD. On 4th November 1942, the Moscow Radio and Press announced the formation of a state commission for the investigation of war crimes. Meanwhile, inter-Allied talks were taking place on the issue of prosecuting German atrocities. At St. James Palace in London on 13 January 1942, the Inter-Allied Commission on the Punishment of War Crimes was established, and on 20th October 1943, representatives of Australia, Belgium, China, Czechoslovakia, France, Greece, Great Britain, India, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Yugoslavia, and the United States signed an agreement setting up the United Nations War Crimes Commission. Each country agreed to establish its own investigatory agencies and to make its documentation available to the commission. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, as early as the summer of 1942, had advocated the establishment of such an international commission, but not until 6 October 1944 did the United States set up its own war crimes office under the aegis of the Judge Advocate General. Throughout the war, American commanders had heard of Axis violations of international law, but such reports were not being systematically collected. On 28 August and again on 6 October 1944, the 12th U.S. Army Group instructed the other armies on the necessity of collecting such material, and a further instruction was dated 7 November 1944. It said, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, SHAEF, has established a standing court of inquiry for the purpose of investigating cases involving the alleged violations by the enemy of the provisions of the Geneva Conventions and the laws and usages of war. The purpose of the investigation of these violations is twofold. A, to furnish a report of cases to United Nations War Crimes Commission as a basis for inclusion of the names of the perpetrators on a list for later apprehension, and B, to furnish the State Department evidence of such violations as a basis for protest to the enemy through diplomatic channels with appropriate publicity in proper cases. The commanding general, 12th Army Group, has been charged with the initial responsibility of assembling the evidence of these violations which occur in the Army Group area. Unquote. Guidelines for the interrogation of witnesses were included in a model questionnaire enclosed. Clearly, the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau was neither a particularly sinister nor typically German invention. Similar bureaucratic institutions existed in most belligerent nations during both world wars. It is important, however, that the Germans set up their bureau very early and that this agency did collect and evaluate a considerable body of witness depositions and other evidentiary material. Well, that's the end of chapter one. That was very interesting background, I think. You notice how the Germans seem to be ganged up on by a number of other major nations, and they get a lot of smaller nations to join up with them. I think that's pretty evident in what we read in Chapter 1. Chapter 2, Genesis, Duties, and Personnel. And now we're fully into the Second World War. At the Nuremberg Trial, number 12, the so-called OKW trial, or Okave trial, the wartime director of the legal department of the Wehrmacht, Rudolf Lehmann, explained the establishment of the War Crimes Bureau within his department. When the first murders and cases of ill treatment against German prisoners of war in Poland were reported, the Bureau was set up with the task of investigating such reports, since we believed at first that they were exaggerations or false reports from the troops. The news about these excesses against German soldiers were so gross that the leadership hesitated to believe them, and this is why only experienced judges were entrusted with the task of ascertaining the facts by taking the sworn deposition of witnesses. The material was systematically ordered and made available to the Foreign Office for the purpose of safeguarding our interests. The Bureau ascertained the occurrence of such abhorrent atrocities and excesses that the results of the investigations could only be read with horror. That's from what Rudolf Lehman testified to, I guess, at the trial. This section is headed Mandate and Membership. Given the incompleteness of the records, it is not possible to pinpoint one particular originator of the War Crimes Bureau. Probably the older judges in the legal department of the Wehrmacht, especially those who had investigated war crimes during World War I, proposed that a similar agency be established. In any case, the Bureau was entrusted with the task of collecting and evaluating all material concerning enemy violations of the laws of war. To facilitate the cooperation of other agencies, its establishment and a description of its assignment were publicized in 3 newspapers, or newsletters, official publications of the Army, Air Force, and Navy. General, later Field Marshal, Wilhelm Keitel signed the decree dated 4th September 1939. The decree said, "In the High Command of the Wehrmacht, in parentheses Legal Department, a Wehrmacht investigative body on violations of the laws of war has been established with the task of ascertaining violations of international law committed by enemy military and civilian persons against members of the German armed forces, and at the same time to investigate whatever accusations foreign countries should make against the German armed forces. The Wehrmacht courts are requested to cooperate in establishing the facts, particularly by taking the depositions of witnesses and experts and by their attestation under oath. In the proceedings, reference to other documents, entries, that is, in parentheses, entries, messages, reports, earlier statements, etc., should be avoided. Instead, all relevant events should be described in detail." Pursuant to this decree, German military judges in the field investigated reports of enemy violations or, at the Bureau's request, took the depositions of specific witnesses and sent the results to Berlin for evaluation. Further, by a decree of 10 October 1939, issued by Minister of Justice Franz Gertner, civilian courts also cooperated with the Bureau in the investigation of enemy war crimes, particularly by taking the deposition of witnesses within their jurisdiction. Local courts were frequently requested by the Bureau to interrogate certain witnesses, especially German soldiers who had been prisoners of war and had been released in the course of POW exchanges arranged by the International Committee of the Red Cross. That the Bureau was the direct successor of its World War I counterpart in the Prussian War Ministry was explained at a meeting of the German Association for Military Policy and Military Science on 28th January 1941 by Bureau head Johannes Golcha. He said, quote, "In keeping with the tradition of the Militarunschungsstelle in the World War and pursuant to its current mandate, the new Wehrmacht Untersuchungsstelle has the responsibility of objectively establishing the facts and the applicable law in cases involving the laws and customs of war. In doing so, the Bureau itself, through its members, takes depositions of witnesses or instructs the competent military or civilian courts to take the necessary depositions. It also evaluates official documents and other reliable evidence," unquote. Although the task was not specifically provided for in the decree of 4 September 1939, the Bureau was also responsible for investigating accusations of war crimes committed by enemy forces against non-Germans. In a letter dated 2nd August 1940, addressed to the High Command of the Army, Field Marshal Keitel observed, quote, "According to news reports and certain information received by the High Command of the Wehrmacht, British and French troops have committed a variety of abuses against the Belgian and French civilian population, in particular killings, ill-treatment, plunder, arson, and other war crimes. The High Command of the Wehrmacht considers it necessary to proceed to a thorough investigation of these events in view of the constant accusations that the enemy is wont to make against the German methods of warfare. At the same time, reliable documentary material should be collected for future peace negotiations, and beyond this, for the eventual claims for compensation which the population of occupied countries may raise vis-a-vis the Reich. The Bureau ought to obtain sworn testimony from the witnesses concerned. End of his statement. Similarly, a memorandum of 7 May 1942 from the Bureau to the intelligence branch of the Wehrmacht High Command declared, quote, evidence of violations of the laws of war by enemy armies against members of the armed forces of other Axis states is also being collected, as well as instances of brutality by enemy troops against the Dutch, Belgian, and French civilian population and against ethnic minorities in enemy states, because evidence of such events may yet prove of importance upon the end of the war and in connection with negotiations for the development of new norms of international law, unquote. Although the decree of 4 September 1939 also gave the Bureau authority to investigate allegations of German war crimes when foreign countries made specific accusations, in practice, that task was assumed by the legal department of the German Foreign Office in collaboration with the military units concerned. Only occasionally did the Bureau receive requests from the Foreign Office in that connection. Sometimes, however, the operations staff of the Wehrmacht asked for lists of similar cases of enemy war crimes for the purpose of using them in the propaganda war by way of Tu-Quote. But the primary task of the Bureau remained that of collecting material on enemy war crimes. It was not a public prosecutor's office charged with indicting violators of the laws of war, nor was it an agency of the German Foreign Office with the mandate to draft and publish white books or to lodge diplomatic protests. What it did was to investigate a multitude of alleged abuses and make the documentation available to a variety of governmental offices, which were then independently responsible for its use. Enough official correspondence and memoranda have survived to present a fairly clear picture of the Bureau's functions. For instance, in a letter dated 27 November 1942 to the 2nd Armored Army with regard to Soviet prisoners of war who were suspected of perpetrating specific war crimes, the Bureau observed, "It is expected that courts-martial will be instituted there against the persons charged," quote unquote. In other words, the Bureau itself did not institute criminal proceedings, but did make documentary evidence available for any eventual court-martial. Subsequently, upon conclusion of a court-martial, it was customary for the military court to forward a copy of its judgment and sentence to the Bureau to complete its files. Similarly, the German Foreign Office forwarded copies of the diplomatic protest notes sent to various belligerent states of all white books dealing with war crimes. The apparent ultimate purpose of the Bureau's documentation is revealed in a 1942 internal memorandum. Quote, our enemies in the World War earnestly endeavored to collect our alleged wartime misdeeds, classify them, and make an indictment out of them so as to brand the Germans as outlaws for all time and thus to disqualify them in the arena of world politics. Because of their inexhaustible propaganda methods, their concerted political pressure, and the weakened stance of post-war German governments, they were largely successful. There is no doubt that upon the conclusion of peace after this war, this disgrace ought to be wiped out. One of the means to this end, which the Wehrmacht should provide for, is the preparation of a catalog of war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by our enemies on land, sea, and in the air. As Rudolf Lehmann testified at Nuremberg, only older, experienced judges were selected to serve in the Bureau. Three permanent members were disabled veterans from World War I. Another was unfit for field service because of a hernia. Organizationally, the Bureau was attached to the International Law Section, Group 3, of the Legal Department of the Wehrmacht, whose chief was an old Privy Councillor and Prussian Army Judge, Maximilian Wagner. He, too, had been involved in the investigation of war crimes during World War I and actively participated in the work of the Bureau until his death in October 1943. Johannes Golcha, his date of birth and death is 1881 to 1953, who headed the Bureau from its inception until its dismantling at the end of the war, was a prominent Berlin lawyer during the Weimar Republic, a noted expert and patron of the arts, and an accomplished amateur musician who occasionally performed at concerts together with the leading German actor Otto Gebühr and museum director Günther Arnold. During World War I, he had been deputy director of the Militaruntersuchungsstelle in the Prussian War Ministry. The other permanent members were Martin Heinemann, 1889 to 1964, judge in the Prussian Supreme Court in Berlin, Hermann Uvendick, 1895 to 1966, judge in the District Court in Bickfield, and Lothar Schirner, 1899 to 1965, judge in Berlin. The Bureau also recruited temporary members who assisted in investigating specific complexes. For instance, when it became necessary after the French campaign in the summer of 1940 to increase the staff, Karl Hoffmann, born in 1903, a public prosecutor from Gießen, was recruited on 7 August via the legal department of the Air Force, to which he had been drafted upon the outbreak of the war. His main activities consisted in traveling throughout Germany, visiting army hospitals, and interrogating convalescent German soldiers with regard to reported instances of enemy war crimes. With the escalation of the war, however, it became necessary to send most able-bodied men to the field. Thus, Hoffmann was transferred from the Bureau to the Russian front on 1 February 1944. Another temporary recruit was Judge Eugen Dorfmüller, born 1897, who carried out many investigations in 1941 and 42, notably for the Yugoslavian dossiers. He also took the sworn depositions of many convalescent German soldiers in hospitals throughout the Reich. Among others called upon to participate were Alfons Waltzog, Air Force judge and expert in international law questions in the legal department of the Wehrmacht, Ulrich Schattenberg, Navy judge, and Army judges Bruno Kleiss, Joachim Scholz, and Horst Rager, who was subsequently personal assistant to Rudolf Lehmann. Although they were sometimes sent to the front to carry out certain investigations on the spot, Bureau members spent most of their time at headquarters evaluating the evidence collected by military judges in the field. The Bureau's offices were originally in Berlin at Blumenhof 17, across from the building of the War Ministry, which was located at Tirpitzfair 7276. It was because of the increasing intensity of Allied air bombardment of Berlin that the Bureau moved on 18 August 1943 to Torgau and established new quarters in the military barracks next to the Supreme Military Court. After moving again in February 1945 to Langenhalse in Thuringia, it continued its activities for several more weeks until it was informally dismantled in April 1945. A few days before the arrival of American troops, the members of the Bureau were transferred to Freising in Bavaria, where no further operations were possible, or in light of the complete collapse of the Reich, even thinkable. The next subtitle is The Performance of German Military Judges. In most countries, the armed forces require the services of, and therefore recruit, a certain number of legal specialists and judges. The German military was no exception. In World War II, it employed some 2,000 judges in its sea, air, and field branches, some of whom were required to investigate enemy war crimes. The primary responsibility of military judges, of course, is to ensure discipline among the troops by various means, including courts-martial. Their daily tasks include the investigation and punishment of cases of theft, disobedience, absence without leave, crimes committed during leave, and in wartime, cases of cowardice, desertion, and self-mutilation. Maintaining discipline among the troops also made it necessary for German military judges to prosecute German soldiers who had committed crimes against the civilian population of occupied countries. Precisely this activity vis-a-vis German soldiers sharpened the military judge's eye for violations of the laws of war, whether committed by German or by enemy soldiers, thus providing experience in investigating and perspective in evaluating such abuses. Although it is difficult to determine whether the same or different criteria were employed in judging German in enemy war crimes, the following examples are representatives of hundreds of cases that can be consulted in the German archives. It is a matter of general knowledge that German soldiers committed a variety of crimes against the Polish civilian population. For instance, on 13 September 1939, in the town of Romberg, near Posen, two German soldiers, named Poffman and Tafler, killed a Polish store owner and then raped his wife. On 15 September 1939, a German court-martial presided over by Alfons Waltzog sentenced both soldiers to die by hanging. Tafler was executed in Bromberg on 9 October 1939. Poffman's sentence, in the course of a clemency plea, was changed to life imprisonment. During the French campaign in May-June 1940, German army judges systematically prosecuted abuses against the French civilian population perpetrated by members of the Wehrmacht. The young soldier Willy Knobloch, lawyer by profession and subsequently military judge, remembers an incident in which a German soldier in his regiment had forced a French woman at gunpoint to have sex with him. A German court-martial sentenced him to death. The German commander gave the French mayor of the town copies of the judgment so that it could be posted in public places. After the collapse of the French army, Hitler issued a decree of 7 July 1940. Hitler's decree reads, "All members of the Wehrmacht must exercise restraint in their relations with the civilian population of occupied territory, as is proper and fitting for a German soldier. Inordinate consumption of alcohol is unbecoming to a soldier and frequently lies at the root of acts of violence and other outrages. Self-induced drunkenness is not an extenuating circumstance in determining the degree of punishment. I expect that every member of the Wehrmacht who, as a result of drunkenness, commits a crime, also vis-a-vis the civilian population, shall be brought to justice and severely punished. In serious cases, the law provides for the death penalty. I declare it to be the official duty of superiors to set an example and to ensure the high level of German discipline by appropriate instructions." The record shows that the majority of the trials and judgments ensuing from this decree were based on the testimony of French witnesses. And since French local police assisted the German military courts in establishing the evidence, convictions could be obtained in 60 to 70% of the cases. Evidence of these German court-martial presented at Nuremberg included the case of two French women who were raped in November 1943 by two drunken German soldiers. Both were sentenced to death by hanging. When two German soldiers, together with French criminals, intimidated French Jews in Nice and forced them to hand over money and jewels, the German court-martial sentenced one of them to death and the other to 12 years imprisonment. The judgment, dated 11 April 1944, declared, "The fact that the violence in question was directed against Jews in no way excuses the perpetrators. The German reputation has thereby suffered," unquote. German military courts in other occupied countries prosecuted German soldiers in similar fashion. In Norway, a German court sentenced a German soldier on 15 June 1940 to 3 years imprisonment for plundering. On 5th January 1945, a German military court in Denmark sentenced a German soldier to 5 years imprisonment for theft committed against a Danish woman. On 23rd September 1943, a German military court in Greece sentenced to death a German soldier who had raped a 16-year-old Greek girl and also assaulted the girl's mother. The situation on the Eastern Front was somewhat different because Hitler's Barbarossa Decree of 13 May 1941 limited the jurisdiction of military courts by removing the automatic requirement to prosecute in cases where soldiers committed arbitrary acts of violence against the local civilian population. The military courts, however, did retain their power to prosecute German soldiers in cases involving the discipline or safety of the troops. Precisely in this connection, Field Marshal Walter von Brauchitsch issued his own decree of 24 May 1941, requiring each military commander and his military court to determine a case-by-case basis whether court-martial proceedings were necessary to ensure the troops' discipline. And since arbitrary and illegal conduct always endangers the discipline of the troops, commanders could order courts-martial based on the Brauchitsch order. Thus, Hitler's original plan to treat the Russians differently and to ignore the crimes of German soldiers against the Russian population was frequently circumvented by old-school commanders who did not believe in total war and who insisted on the observance of the laws of war by their troops. The following cases illustrate the schizophrenic nature of the Nazi system, whereby Hitler could order crimes against humanity while many of his commanders continued to demand strict discipline and respect for the civilian population of occupied territories. Well, here we come to one of the key problems that Hitler faced in waging war in the Soviet Union, and it was the lack of agreement by many of his top commanders, top generals, and of course Brauchitsch was the supreme commander in following his orders. Gotthard Heinrici, commander-in-chief of the German Fourth Army, simply sat on Hitler's decree and did not pass it down to his field commanders. Instead, he ordered that, quote, offenses against the civilian Russian population shall be punished by disciplinary sanctions or by court-martial, unquote. As the supreme legal authority, he was also responsible for confirming death sentences and did so in the course of the Barbarossa campaign, including those of three members of the 25th Armored Division for killing five women, two members of the 267th Division for plundering, and two members of the 260th Division for the rape and murder of a woman. Georg Lindemann, commander-in-chief of the 18th Army, also confirmed death sentences of German soldiers, as did Eberhard von Mackensen, commander-in-chief of the 14th Army, who similarly ignored Hitler's Barbarossa decree and preferred to keep his own house in order to the extent possible. He ordered his chief judge, Adolf Bloch, to prosecute every crime of a German soldier against the civilian population or against prisoners of war. In April 1943, Judge Bloch sentenced to death a German soldier who had killed a Russian woman in a village 15 kilometers east of Gorlauka. The court-martial took place one day after the crime. The execution was carried out one day after the judgment, and General von Mackensen ordered that the judgment be posted on placards in the village and brought to the attention of the troops. The next section, and the final section, is subtitled The Wehrmacht Legal Department and National Socialism. It may appear surprising that military judges could continue functioning more or less normally in spite of the pressures imposed by a totalitarian dictatorship in total war. Several factors, however, were responsible for the relative independence of the judges of the Wehrmacht, beginning with the organizational structure of the German state, which by law separated the armed forces from political parties. This made it difficult for the Nazis to influence Wehrmacht commanders directly. In parentheses, a Gauleiter, or district party leader, could not simply order a Wehrmacht officer around, naturally. And even less the Wehrmacht judges, who were imbued with Prussian traditions, and many of whom had already served as military judges during World War I. Former Army Judge Walter Hoffman describes the situation as follows. Quote, I became an Army judge on 1 May 1937, and at no time did I receive any orders or instructions from a party official, neither in peacetime nor during the war. Even in one case where I had to sit as a judge in court-martial proceedings against a high functionary of the Nazi Party in occupied Russia, no attempt was made by the party to influence the proceedings. Army courts in the field were entirely free from such pressures. A similar view was expressed by Wilhelm Weber, a former Army judge and subsequently member of the Supreme Court of the Federal Republic of Germany. Quote, during my entire career as an Army judge until the end of the war, I was never subjected to any influence from the party, nor for that matter from the commanders, I functioned under five commanders-in-chief, and it was off-limits for the party. Army judges were independent, unquote. It is also interesting to note that at the top of the Wehrmacht legal office, there were no National Socialist Party members. Rudolf Lehmann, chief of the legal department of the armed forces, Christian Freiherr von Hammerstein, chief of the legal department of the Air Force, Karl Sack, chief of the legal department of the Army, Johannes Rudolfi, chief of the legal department of the Navy, Maximilian Wagner, chief of the section for international law, and Johannes Golcha, chief of the War Crimes Bureau, all kept clear of the party. This particular constellation explains how it was possible for many jurists who had trouble with the Nazi Party or who feared persecution because of their political opinions to find refuge in the legal department of the Wehrmacht. Former Supreme Court Justice Wilhelm Weber described how he became an army judge. Quote, I was a county judge when Hitler came to power in 1933. I had intended to join the Ministry of Justice, but I was unable to obtain my transfer there because I had a negative encounter with the Nazi Party leader, the Gauleiter, competent for Saxonia. I thus remained longer than usual an assistant judge in the High Court of Dresden. There I was relieved of my responsibilities as an instructor of junior barristers since I was, quote, unreliable, unquote, and not a party member. Thus I gradually realized that I had no chance of career development in the High Court. Since I was in the Army Reserve as a former cavalry officer, I decided to request my transfer to the legal department of the Army. There I was questioned on the reason for my wanting to re-enter the Army. I explained that I had had friction with the party, that I was not a party member, and that I was effectively blocked. Thereupon, I was accepted. I know of a whole series of persons who sought an escape from the party by joining the military. So there's another clash between the party and the military being alluded to here. Another former judge in the Supreme Court of the Federal Republic of Germany, Otto Grünwald, became a civil servant with the Hessian Ministry of Justice in Darmstadt in 1933 and was fired without explanation during a vacation in 1935. He then turned to Karl Sack, later head of the legal department of the Army, who himself had left the Hessian Ministry of Justice and gone to the military in 1934. The result was that Sack immediately hired him as legal expert. During the war, Grünwald was chief judge of the Third Army and then chief of the section on military justice in the field directly under Sack. Yet another example is that of the senior army judge Adolf Bloch. After completion of my legal studies, I became a judge. This is a quote by Bloch. Since I did not want to join the NSDAP and its influence was increasingly felt in the courts, I decided to seek admission in the legal department of the Wehrmacht. From 1938 until the end of the war, I was a judge with the Supreme Military Court. In between, from December 1942 to the end of July 1943, I was a chief judge of the 1st Armored Army in Russia, unquote. Understandably, however, the legal department of the Wehrmacht could hardly have survived in Nazi Germany without accepting some party members into its rank. Moreover, it became increasingly difficult to find young jurists without links, at least pro forma, to some party agency or branch. Indeed, a decree of the Minister of Justice dated 11 May 1934 practically forced all students of law into a party organization. Those who did not join were not only ostracized, but frequently unable to continue their studies. The Wehrmacht did accept some party members, but only after careful scrutiny. Moreover, by an established rule of the military, party membership was deemed to be suspended during military service. The question still remains whether in the course of time, military justice gradually embraced or adjusted to the tenets of National Socialism. Certainly, there were individuals who did so. Judge Otto Schweinsberger, for instance, refused to prosecute a German civilian administrator in Russia who had murdered 75 Jews in the town of Balabanowka. In a written statement against the indictment for murder, he explained that he felt himself equally responsible as a National Socialist and as a judge. His attitude was highly disapproved of by his superiors, and he was removed from the case. And in parentheses, in the criminal proceedings that followed, however, the indictment was changed from murder to manslaughter, and the new judge sentenced Inspector Weisheit only to a demotion and 2 years imprisonment. Shortly thereafter, Weisheit was sent to the front as a private and fell in combat. Schweinsberger cannot be considered typical of German military judges. Even a cursory study of the personnel records of the military legal department reveals a great many opponents of National Socialism. Helmut James Graf von Moltke, chief of a section of Wehrmacht intelligence and a close collaborator of Johannes Goltzschuh, was the founder of the Christ Our Christ, one of the most courageous anti-Hitler groups. He was executed in Berlin on 23rd January 1945. Karl Sack, who we've already heard about, high-level person, was involved in the conspiracy to assassinate Hitler on 20th July 1944 and was executed on 9th April 1945 at the Flossenbürg concentration camp. So too, Rudolf Schleicher, chief of the legal department of the Air Force, 1934 to 1939, who was executed in April 1945. It was precisely because of such men that Hitler did not allow the treason proceedings following the assassination attempt to be held before military courts. In fact, his decree of 20 September 1944 ordered that no proceedings against soldiers for political offenses should be brought before military courts. Instead, he called into being the extraordinary courts, and at the top, the infamous People's Court, under the fanatical Roland Freisler. But Hitler's hate and mistrust of the Wehrmacht lawyers had surfaced well before the events of 20 July 1944. As early as 1939, shortly after the successful campaign in Poland, he had created a separate, more reliable, and more political system of justice, establishing special SS and police courts. Illustrative of his contempt for traditional military justice is the fact that during the entire war, he avoided any direct contact with Wehrmacht lawyers and never conferred with either Rudolf Lehmann or Johannes Goltzschuh. Well, that's the end of Chapter 2, and that brings us into some interesting ideas here. It's clear that our author, Alfred Zayas, is in sympathy with the anti-Hitler forces, which I made clear in the announcement for these readings, but this fact also assures us that there was no pro-National Socialist bias leading to false statements or conclusions protecting Hitler's National Socialist government and policies, that it was able to keep itself totally independent from Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, but it also shows the serious division going on right from the start of the Eastern Campaign. I want to mention that at the very end of Chapter 2, Desaius mentions Helmuth James Graf von Moltke, and he speaks of him with great approval. Von Moltke was one of the plotters of the July 20th assassination attempt in 1944. I don't speak of him with great approval, so there is a big difference of opinion here. I want to say a few words about this person, because von Moltke is going to come up again in Chapter 3. He was a great-grandnephew of Helmut von Moltke the Elder, who was the victorious commander in the Austro-Prussian and Franco-Prussian wars. This was a person whom Adolf Hitler admired greatly and had a portrait of him in one of his private rooms at Berchtesgaden, along with Frederick the Great. It was from his great-grand-uncle that this Helmuth James Graf von Moltke inherited the Kreisau estate in Prussian Silesia. And it is at this Kreisau estate that he had secret meetings of resistance people called the Christ Something Circle. But this von Moltke was an active member. He was half British through his mother, and he studied in London and Oxford. Both his parents were avid Christian Scientists, and he had a pretty religious outlook on life. From 1935, he had a private law practice in international law, during which he helped Jews and other people who needed help to emigrate. In 1939, when war started, he was drafted into the Abwehr as an expert in martial law and international law. His main job was to provide appraisals of questions of the international laws of war, but like so many others, he was all caught up in issues of morality, chivalry, and humanitarianism. He thought this justified him in his treason. Well, they all did. They wanted a better world than what they thought Adolf Hitler was creating for Germany. Some of what Moltke did was to spread confidential information regarding the war and the concentration camps to friends and members of the resistance in occupied Europe. He was especially upset over the concentration camps. There was a far-reaching network throughout Europe and going outside of Europe of this resistance movement. And special note here that he got reports to Roosevelt and also into Great Britain, but nothing came of it. They knew what they wanted to do. They knew what was going on as far as they were concerned. So they weren't interested in helping these moralists in Germany. Now, Moltke was arrested in January 1944 before the bomb plot took place, but he was not sentenced until January 1945. He was just arrested because they realized he was behaving in a treasonous manner, and he was held, but it was in January 1945 when so many of the traitors and plotters had been discovered and been sentenced and so on, that he was also sentenced. So now I want to turn also to Hitler's Barbarossa Decree of May 13, 1941, which was referred to, came a month before the invasion. It shows that Hitler saw the war in the East against Bolshevism as different in essence from all previous enemies and wars. I think I should read it. It's not very long, and it's going to play a part in the rest of the material. So I think it's important to know exactly what was in that decree. And it says, decree on the jurisdiction of martial law and on special measures of the troops. That was the title of it. It goes on, the exercise of martial law serves primarily to maintain military discipline. The wide extent of operational space in the East, the form of combat that this offers, and the peculiarity of the enemy, interesting way to put it, the peculiarity of the enemy, presents tasks to the court-martial that, with their limited personnel, they can only solve if military law restricts itself for the time being to its central task. That is only possible if the troops themselves defend themselves against every threat from the enemy civilian population without mercy. Then it has two parts. Number one, treatment of criminal acts by enemy civilians. One, criminal acts of enemy civilians are withdrawn until further notice from the jurisdiction of courts-martial and summary courts. Two, guerrillas are to be dispatched without mercy by the troops, either in combat or while trying to escape. Three, furthermore, all other articles by enemy civilians against the Wehrmacht, its members and retinue, are to be repelled on the spot by the most extreme measures up to the destruction of the attacker. What he's saying there is that criminal acts by enemy civilians are not going to go under the jurisdiction of the military courts, that they're going to be taken care of by the troops, and as he puts it, either in combat or while trying to escape. So whatever executions are done, they will be indicated as death in combat or while trying to escape. Any other attacks by civilians who are, if they're attacking the Wehrmacht, they're the enemy, and they can be taken care of on the spot by the most extreme measure, well, by execution or by shooting. Number four, where measures of this kind were missed or were initially not possible, the suspicious elements are to be immediately brought before an officer. He will decide whether they are to be shot. Collective drastic action will be taken immediately against communities from which treacherous or insidious attacks against the Wehrmacht are launched on the orders of an officer with at least the rank of battalion commander upwards, if the circumstances do not permit a speedy apprehension of individual culprits. So if someone is suspicious, but you're not sure, then you're to bring them before an officer, and it's the officer's duty to decide what to do about this person, whether to shoot him or not. If the culprit is not apprehended, but he's coming from a community, he's being harbored by a community, then the collective action will be taken against the community in order to discourage them harboring these kinds of elements. And number five is, it is expressly forbidden to detain suspected culprits in order to hand them over to the courts when jurisdiction over native inhabitants is restored to these. I think that means that it's forbidden to hold culprits who have done some damage that you know of, that you have caught, and to hold them in order to hand them over to local courts when they might come back into operation, say. You're not allowed, he's saying, to hold on to these enemy culprits, to keep them under arrest and to just hold on to them. Something has to be done about them in order to end the situation. Now part two, which is really the part that has to do with what Desaias was talking about, and it's headed, treatment of criminal acts by members of the Wehrmacht or its retinue against native civilians. Number one is the key one. For acts which members of the Wehrmacht or its retinue commit against enemy civilians, there is no compulsion to prosecute, even when the act represents at the same time a military crime or offense. So simply saying that if a member of the Wehrmacht commits something against an enemy civilian, knowing that it's an enemy, there is no need to prosecute, even if it's a military crime or offense under military law. This is what got the general so upset, I guess, what they refused to go along with. Number two, in judging such deeds, it is to be considered in any proceedings that the collapse in the year 1918, the later period of suffering of the German people, and the battle against National Socialism with the movement's countless sacrifices of blood are incontestably to be attributed to Bolshevik influence, and that no German has forgotten that. This is Hitler's reasoning and justification for the number one that I just read. He is saying that what the Germans have gone through is all attributed to Bolshevism, and so we don't need to have any sympathy whatsoever for anything to do with Bolshevism, and it has to be wiped out, as he says, without mercy. Because if you start bringing in mercy, there's no end to it. You cannot wipe it out that way. Number three, the chairman of the court must therefore examine whether a disciplinary reprimand is appropriate or whether it is necessary to institute judicial proceedings. The chairman only orders court-martial proceedings for acts against native inhabitants when the maintenance of discipline or the protection of the troops demands it. So here he's giving an out here. He's saying that you can do what he's just saying he doesn't want you to do when the maintenance of discipline or the protection of the troops demands it. That applies, for example, in the case of serious acts that result from the loss of sexual restraint, that is when they rape, are derived from a criminal disposition, that is, you have German troops who are just naturally criminal-minded, and there are some of those, or are a sign that the troops are threatening to run wild. They're losing their discipline. Criminal acts by which lodging or supplies or other plunder are senselessly destroyed to the detriment of our own troops are not, on the whole, to be judged more leniently. But what he's saying there is, I think, that if some of these civilians destroy lodgings that are needed by the troops or destroy supplies that are needed by the troops or otherwise plunder things that are needed by the troops, that's as much a crime as any of the above. I think all in all, the judgment is that if the troops are not misbehaving generally, then there's no need to make examples of a few that have done something against the people of the enemy population there. There's no need to make an example. Unless the maintenance of discipline is in jeopardy, then you would need to do it. What Hitler is saying in this decree is that we're dealing with a different situation here, and we need to behave differently, and this is the way you should be looking at it. But as we know, that didn't come across to many of the commanding generals because they thought more of their personal honor and their personal standards that they are used to as military officers, the tradition and so on, that they were not going to jeopardize that, or they were not going to corrupt themselves in their own eyes, no matter what. So they said, I don't agree with this, and that was how they operated. And whether who's right and wrong here, it's up to you. It's up to how you look at it. This is brought out in the readings that I'm going to be doing here. So it's a good opportunity to look at these questions and see what your own answer is. This ends the first reading in this series. Please look for the next one when I will begin with Chapter 3. This is Carolyn Yeager on June 21st, 2015, saying, so long for now.